militia. He hadn't known Klausner was working with the Desert Hawks Brigade, and this sucked, because he knew all about them and what they were doing in Syria. At the darkest portion of the war for Azam, he signed a decree that allowed businessmen to raise their own militias to defend their capital assets. This action, in one fell swoop, turned the smugglers, conmen, and kleptocrats of the nation into warlords. The Desert Hawks Brigade became one of the most successful and violent pro-regime armies in the conflict. Independent of the Syrian military chain of command, they helped the regime by fighting its enemies. But they were also able to spend their time stealing and smuggling, assassinating their rivals in the underworld. Working for the Hawks in Syria was a little like working for both the Nazis and the Mafia at the same time. The Desert Hawks Brigade was infamous. They regularly tortured and killed men, women, and children, and now court would be shoulder to shoulder with these monsters. Suiting up for the Desert Hawks meant court would probably be asked to do some horrible things, but if he wanted to maintain his cover, he'd have to comply. And there was another downside to using this means to get into Syria. As soon as he broke away from the Desert Hawks and went for the baby, Kurt knew the affable but imposing German sleeping nearby in the master bedroom would probably become a sworn enemy. But that was a problem for another day. Pissing off the president of a company that rented out mercenaries to train and kill for Third World death squads didn't seem like a great idea, but Kurt figured getting into Syria on his own with a good cover legend about what he was doing there was worth the risk. This was going to be a tricky operation, to say the least. And the fact that he did not know how much time he had before Ahmed Azam decided to remove the compromise of his child and simply move him or kill him only made Court's operation to come more unsure. He closed his eyes and willed himself to catch a couple of hours' rest, because he knew one thing. Right here, right now, lying in a closet in Munich, there wasn't a fucking thing he could do about what would happen tomorrow in Syria. Chapter 25. Jamal Medina began to cry. The house had been quiet since the four-month-old baby finally went to sleep 2 hours earlier, but Jamal was letting all within earshot know that it was time for a late-night feeding. The au pair had been dozing on a mat near the crib. The baby had the more luxurious arrangement, but she sat up quickly and checked the clock. It was 11:15 p.m., a little earlier than usual for Jamal to want to eat again, but the only thing the au pair found consistent with the baby was inconsistency, so she was not surprised in the least. Yasmin was the only person in the home allowed to handle the baby, but she was not the only person in the home. She was surrounded by five security men, all Alawis, and all members of a specially vetted bath party unit, chosen for their skill and their support for the Azam regime. Yasmin Samara was a 24-year-old Sunni Syrian and the granddaughter of the former Speaker of the Syrian People's Council, a Ba'ath Party official who served both Ahmed al-Azam and his father before him. She had worked as an au pair in France for 3 years, then returned home to take a job as the nanny of a wealthy expatriate woman who lived in Meza. It wasn't until she was brought in to meet a very pregnant Bianca and garnered her approval that she was told the father of the baby she would be looking out for was the president of the nation. Bianca stressed that she could not mention this to a soul, but it wasn't until Ahmed Azam himself dropped in on his new child that she understood the full scope of the danger she was in. Azam was kind to her, but when he left one of his security officers behind a moment to remind her to keep her silence, and that any failure to do so would be a criminal act. Yasmin was the right girl for the job because she was an excellent nanny, and she hadn't breathed a word to anyone, not even her family. Bianca had been due back earlier in the day, but Yasmin had not heard any news from her. She wondered if the beautiful Spanish model had found some excuse to stay in Europe a little longer, but she doubted this, because Bianca had confided in her that Ahmed Azam barely let her go in the first place, and sticking around overseas was a surefire way to make him angry. Yasmin was deathly afraid of Ahmed Azam, although he'd been in her life for all her life. Bianca, on the other hand, didn't seem to be afraid at all. The married man was obviously in love with his Spaniard. Bianca would tell Yasmin stories about his awkward romantic acts that made the young au pair blush. As she carried Jamal into the kitchen tonight for yet another feeding, she rubbed the dark hair on the top of his head and sang him a little song with a tired voice. At the bottom of the stairs, she saw lights appear in the circular driveway out front. Yasmin felt sure it would be Bianca, finally home from her trip, and she was glad she'd bathed Jamal just before bedtime. As Yasmin stood in the living room, a security man climbed off the sofa, slipped his suit coat back on to cover the pistol in a shoulder holster, and looked out the window in the entryway. But only for a second. Then, with wide eyes, he spun around and looked at Yasmin.
It's him.
Him could only mean one thing. The president of Syria was making an unannounced visit to the home where his mistress and his son lived. Now Yasmin was doubly glad she bathed the boy. Ahmed Azam looked positively drained when he marched through the door behind the four bodyguards. He stepped past the security men already working here in the house and up to Yasmin. He didn't look at his son at all as he stared her down.
Have you heard from her?
Yasmin shook her head.
La Sayedi?
No, sir.
She said nothing to you about her trip.
Yasmin did not meet her employer's gaze. She only stared at the floor.
She said she was nervous.
Nervous?
About being back on the runway. It had been so long. She was worried about her looks after the baby, getting back in shape. Things like that.
Had she been acting strangely before she left? Any calls to the home from people you did not recognize?
Yasmin's huge, wide eyes darted up to Azam, then back down to the floor. What is going on?
La Sayedi.
No, sir.
She is missing, Azam said. I do not know when she will return. While she is away, I will place more security here around you. You are not to leave the house. You are not to talk on the phone.
Nem Sayedi.
Yes, sir. He put his hand on the boy's head, stroked it for a moment, and again Yasmin stole a look at her employer, an expression of frustration, anger, and... was it fear? Ahmed looked away from his son and back to Yasmin.
If she contacts you in any way, I will know it.
Of course, Mr. President.
Azam reached out and put his hand on the side of Yasmin's face.
Your grandfather was a great man, daughter. He was a friend to my family for a long time. I miss him every day.
She started to thank him, but her voice caught in her throat, as his hand lowered from her face, traced down the side of her neck, over her shoulder, down again, and then onto her chest. He stopped there, opened her robe a little, and slid a cold hand inside and around one of her breasts. She worried he could feel her heartbeat. Worried that her high heart rate from her near-panicked state would anger him or make him think she was lying. Yasmin said,
The Samara family has always been honored to serve the Azam family.
Azam looked at her a moment more, then drew his hand away, like a snake slipping back into the tall grass. He turned away without another word. Yasmin watched him step over to the head of the guard force of the house.
How many men do you have here?
5, sir. Around the clock.
Make it 10. And find a way to double the security throughout the neighborhood.
Of course, Mr. President. Is there any specific threat I should know about, sir?
Azam turned for the door.
Yes. Me. If you fail to protect my child.
As Ahmed Al-Azam climbed back into his SUV, he thought again of just ordering Yasmin and Jamal shot and disposed of. He had great plans for the boy, true. But if his son was exposed, if Bianca talked and compromised the child, then the plans for his son's future as the male heir would become null and void. But he did not give the order for his men to kill the two. He told himself he'd give Sebastian Drexler time to get to France, to find his lover, and to determine what the hell had happened. If she could prove that she had nothing to do with her disappearance, and that she had been careful about what she had said to those who took her, then his plan for the future, new wife, new son, new heir, new relationship with Russia and Iran, and new strength at home with the total conquest of his domestic enemies, would remain intact. If not, if he was left with any doubts at all about Bianca's culpability in all this, then he would not allow his weakness to show. He would instead simply erase any evidence that Jamal had ever happened. Chapter 26. Sidnaya Prison was lodged in the mountains 20 miles north of Damascus, near the hillside town of the same name. It was a massive walled complex with two main structures, the large square white building and the even larger tri-winged red building. The prison had originally been built to process and hold a few thousand inmates, but since the war began, the population had soared. Now more than 15,000 prisoners were locked in cramped, foul, and cruel conditions inside, mostly in appalling cells along the echoing hallways that ran down the long wings of the red building. Windowless chambers, originally built for solitary confinement in both the red and white buildings, now held 9 at a time, and the group cells were used to house many times that number. Deaths from beatings, malnutrition, dehydration, and denial of medical care were common, but these were not the main causes of death here at Sidnaya. No. Most people who died here were killed during the mass executions carried out in the dead of night in the basement of the White Building, where groups of 20 to 50 blindfolded men convicted in kangaroo courts were hanged by the neck simultaneously, their bodies then loaded into trucks like bags of flour to be dumped in unmarked mass graves in the nearby hills. Killing enemies of the regime, be they combatant, protester, journalist, or others, was the regime's only real answer to any threats to the rule of Ahmed Azzam. Tens of thousands had been hanged since the beginning of the war, mostly here at Sidnaya, and Amnesty International referred to the complex as a human slaughterhouse. Sebastian Drexler pulled up to the lower gate of the prison at 8 a.m. and shifted his white Mercedes E-Class into park at the guard shack. This wasn't his first time at the facility, so he knew the routine. He handed his identity badge and government credentials over to the guards, received a grounds visitor's badge, waited for a jeep to meet him, then followed the jeep up the hill. Together, the two vehicles drove the long winding road across brown earth towards the complex. Here, Drexler parked in a tree-lined lot located between the red and white buildings, pulled out a wheeled suitcase and a leather portfolio, climbed into the jeep with his luggage, and rode with 3 intelligence officers from the Political Security Directorate into the main gate of the red building. The jeep parked by the main door, and 4 men got out and showed their credentials through bulletproof glass, and then they were buzzed in and allowed to move freely around the main portion of the facility. On all his previous visits to the red building, Drexler had gone into the main entrance, then taken the hall to the right towards the interrogation section, where he would either question prisoners or meet with interrogators to pick up intelligence. Today, he and his chaperones made a left at visitor processing and headed towards the infirmary. By 8:30, he and the 3 intelligence officers were drinking tea in a conference room, and here Drexler was introduced to a dark-bearded man in his 50s and a taller man with white hair in his 60s. They were both vascular surgeons from Tishrin Military Hospital in Damascus, and the senior of the two, Dr. Qureshi, had been brought up to Sidnaya the day before to take charge of today's procedure.
"Is everything ready?"
an anxious Drexler asked the white-haired surgeon. Qureshi turned to the director of the prison for an answer. The director said,
"Yes, the prisoner has been held in the White Building, which is primarily for short-term housing of political prisoners, but the medical facilities here at the Red Building are superior. So we are having him brought over here to us."
"Fine," Drexler replied. "We must not begin the procedure until the helicopter has landed. Everything is dependent on timing. I cannot waste one moment once we start."
"Understood," Dr. Qureshi said. "I have 8 other doctors and nurses with me. They all know their roles. I was the lead surgeon on the test cases that were done last year. We will be fast, as you have requested."
the other surgeon said.
We have trained on the process. The notes you provided us and the research you have done on the process were very helpful. But this will be my first implementation in the field. We spent yesterday afternoon practicing the operation. We are ready.
Drexler sniffed.
I'll hold my applause until I make it through immigration in Europe.
The dark-haired surgeon said,
Of course, sir.
30 minutes later, a Soviet-era Mi-8 helicopter landed at the heliport outside the Red Building, and Drexler's luggage was loaded on board. Shortly thereafter, he was called into a windowless room just down the hall from the main operating suite of the infirmary. Two prison guards stood against the far wall, bracketing a man in a prison uniform standing there, shackled to the wall. Drexler looked him up and down. He was a healthy man of average height, with very light brown hair, just a few shades darker than Drexler's. The prisoner just stared back at him silently, unsure who this non-Arab man was or what language he spoke. Drexler addressed him in English.
Your name is Veti Tikala. You are 36 years old, and you are from Finland.
The man nodded his head vigorously.
Yes, that's right. I am a videographer working for ITN. I was taken from my hotel room last night. All my papers are in order.
I know they are, and I appreciate that.
I am not a spy.
I know that too. If I were you, I wouldn't be here.
Who are you?
Well, I'll tell you who I'm not. I'm not the lifeline you were hoping for. The prisoner's eyebrows furrowed.
I don't understand. I demand to speak to my embassy.
Afraid that won't be possible. The locals here don't have the best consular system around, I can tell you that. And unfortunately, there is no Finnish consulate outstation here in Senaya prison.
Drexler chuckled at his joke and looked at the guards, but they did not speak English, so the humor was lost on them. The prisoner just cocked his head, regarding Drexler as if he were mad.
The problem is, the Swiss man continued, that you have something that I desperately need.
What do I have? I had a backpack with me in my hotel room. Check it out. You can have anything. Cameras, computer, money, anything you...
What I really need, actually, is your identity. I must make my way into Europe, and that is a problem. You see, I was a very bad boy once.
He held up a hand and corrected his last statement.
More than once, to be perfectly frank. So the Europeans don't like me. In fact, they are hunting me down. I had a little plastic surgery on my face 2 years ago, so it is difficult for their cameras and computers to recognize me. But to get into Europe, it is more difficult. With your identity, however, I can travel freely.
The Finn nodded slowly, thinking he understood.
I get it. You need my passport.
He was conspiratorial now. It's true. You and I look similar. We're about the same size, same age. You can use it. Just let me go.
Drexler nodded along with the Finn for a moment. They both smiled. And then Drexler continued smiling, but his up-and-down head bob suddenly turned into a left-and-right shake of the head. Still smiling, still happy as he could be, Drexler said,
But you don't get it, man. You don't understand.
Viti Tikala stopped smiling.
Don't understand what?
A passport alone won't work.
What do you want, then?
It's not what I want, friend. It's what I need.
I need...
Drexler reached inside his jacket, drew his FN pistol from his shoulder holster, and flipped off the safety.
I need your fingerprints, and there's just no pleasant way to take them from you while you're alive. So... I'll do you the kind gesture of making this easy for you.
The Finn's face went white, and his eyes locked on the gun. Sebastian Drexler leveled the gun at the man's heart.
I don't know if you are curious, but I've been told by the doctors that the moment this gun goes bang, I will have fewer than 36 hours to get into Europe before the prints begin to decay.
The Finn started to hyperventilate. Through it, though, he was able to croak out,
Sir! I beg of you.
Don't beg. I am you now, and you are me. I would never lower myself to begging.
Drexler took a step back and fired one round into the man's chest.
The blast in the small room was ear-splitting. The 5.7-millimeter projectile tore through the Finn's heart at a range of less than 3 meters. The guard standing next to the prisoner held him by the shoulders as he crumpled forward, then pushed him back up against the wall as Drexler himself helped to unhook T'Challa's wrists from his shackles. Drexler then stepped to the side. Two male medical attendants wheeled a gurney straight into the room, and together with the others, they laid the prisoner down. The victim was on his back and being rolled out of the holding room, before his eyes flitted and rolled up, and the last breath escaped his lungs. As they pushed him up the hallway towards the operating room, Drexler shouted out in Arabic,
"The clock is ticking. Watch the hands. Take care of the fingers. Those are mine now."
Drexler could not watch the procedure on the body. He had to get himself prepped. So, while the surgeon and his team worked in the operating room, Drexler undressed and took a quick shower. After this, he entered another operating room, sat on a chair waiting for him there, and reached his hands over a table covered with blue surgical draping. Nurses positioned his arms so his hands faced up, and leather bindings were wrapped around his wrists so he could not move them. Some time later, Dr. Qureshi entered the room, carrying stacks of interlocking metal pans. Everything was arrayed on tray tables near Drexler, and while he watched the clock, Qureshi and his team went to work. The surgical team began with the pinky finger on Drexler's left hand. They applied a caustic solvent on the fingertip to roughen it up, and the patient grunted with pain, but he urged the surgeon to continue. A silicone gum was spread in a thin sheet on the skin to protect it, and then Qureshi took a soggy wet piece of live natural sponge out of a dish of salt water with a pair of forceps. This the surgeon cut to the size of Drexler's fingertip, taking his time to make a precise little oval. Some high-end fingerprint readers have a feature designed to ensure that the prints are not silicone imprints or harvested from cadavers by using software to compare the spatial moisture pattern of a finger's pores to detect natural secretions. But Drexler knew a spoof for this. The small organic sponge, saturated with salt water and a little glycerin and placed carefully under the cadaver print, kept the dead skin moist longer, and it allowed just enough dampness to register on the surface. Once the sponge was glued in place with a latex adhesive that bonded with the skin, the surgeon lowered surgical eye loops over his eyes to magnify Drexler's fingers. He very carefully reached a set of straight blade forceps into a dish marked Elhan 5, in Arabic, to indicate the pinky finger. And he retrieved Viti T'Challa's pink flesh. Drexler was surprised how thick the dead skin was. He had pictured something translucent, like an onion peel, but the surgeon held up a dense and opaque chunk of human tissue. Drexler asked,
"How are you going to make that look natural on my finger?"
The surgeon did not look up from his magnifier.
"The cement I will use on the sides will be tinted to your skin tone."
He shrugged a little, though he kept working.
"A close examination of your hand will reveal that these fingerprints are not your own, but it will still be difficult to detect. The Mukhabarat will hold you personally accountable if I fail, Doctor. If that was not clear before, let me stress it now."
Looking through his magnifying loops, the surgeon put cement on the sides of the dead flesh, very carefully, as if he were painting a tiny figurine. As he did this, he said,
"I am the best vascular surgeon in Damascus. I am not, however, a cosmetic surgeon. You have my full capabilities at your disposal, and you will not leave here until I am certain I cannot provide you with better results. If that is not good enough, then I suppose we will both suffer. Brauwipe."
Drexler cocked his head at the exclamation, but understood when a nurse stepped in and blotted the surgeon's forehead. Qureshi continued,
"In the meantime, sir, I must ask you to stop talking. You will have your job to do wherever it is you need these new fingerprints to take you. But for now, allow me to do my job. It would be a pity if your threats caused me to perspire all over my masterpiece."
Drexler wondered if Qureshi knew he could have him thrown into his cell here at Sednaya for his attitude, even if he did a perfect job on his hands. But he let the surgeon slide for now. Qureshi placed T'Challa's fingertip over Drexler's finger and pressed it into place. He added more cement around the sides, tinted it with a paintbrush and a natural coloring, and placed a piece of plastic over the finger. Then his assisting surgeon used padded tissue forceps to hold the fingertip in place while Qureshi went on to the pinky finger on the right hand. Back and forth they went on like this, left hand to right and then back to left, one finger at a time. It was a slow and meticulous process, and the surgeon weathered the periodic admonitions of his patient throughout. Drexler kept an eye on the clock across the room and watched it tick away, and he took out his frustrations on Dr. Qureshi, but the surgeon remained steadfast, and he got the job done. Just after the two-hour point, the white-haired Syrian gently clamped the padded forceps onto the last finger, the thumb on the right hand. He looked up at his patient.
I am aware you understand the protocol, but I will remind you, you will need to keep these moist. A lotion will travel in your DOP kit. It is marked as a store brand, but in actuality, it is made for use in cadaver labs in Europe and America to keep necrotic tissue fresh. Use it every 2 hours. Even so, the flesh will begin to deteriorate in 36 hours, and the sponge secretions will have dried out by then as well.
Sebastian Drexler wore oversized gloves to protect his fingers as he walked out to the waiting helicopter, already spooling up on the launch pad behind the red building. His three intelligence officer escorts climbed into the MI-8 with him, and within seconds they had lifted off towards the airport in Damascus. As they flew high over the green landscape, Drexler had one of the Mukhabarat men place a call to a phone number he gave him from memory. A headset was placed on Drexler's head, and he waited to hear a woman's voice answer on the other line.
Yes?
It was Shakira Azam.
It's me. I'm leaving now. I'll be on the ground there late this evening.
The US and Europeans had massive amounts of electronic intelligence assets pointed at Syria, and even though it was difficult to grab a satellite call, Drexler knew he needed to stay vague when speaking on an open line. Shakira Azam replied.
And my husband knows you are going?
Yes. He asked me personally to go and attend to the issue.
Well, he and I both want you to have a successful journey, but he and I are after a different outcome.
You can rely on me.
I want updates.
A pause.
And I look forward to your safe return. If something should delay you, I will reach out to my own contacts abroad to try to find you, in case you need some help.
Drexler knew this was a not-so-veiled threat against him trying to run from Syria.
I will be home within days, my darling.
And we will celebrate.
Shakira hung up the phone, and Drexler nodded to one of the officers in the back of the MI-8, who then removed the headset.
The Swiss intelligence agent looked out the window now, as the hills below gave way to the northern suburbs of Damascus, anxious but supremely confident about the mission ahead of him.
Chapter 27. Court Gentry sat in the back of a 25-year-old Saab 340 turboprop, his mind full of worry about the mission ahead of him. He was winging it, he knew, and until he got on the ground and took in the lay of the land, he would have no way of planning his next move. The vibration of the landing gear lowering into place below his feet brought him back into awareness of his surroundings. He looked out the window over his right shoulder. All he could see from this vantage point was the endless green sea. The aircraft seemed like it couldn't have been more than 1,000 feet in the air, but just then, the plane entered a hard bank to the north, tipping Court forward in his side-facing seat. And when it leveled off, he looked out the window again and saw whitewashed buildings on the coastline, then terraced olive fields on a hillside. It looked utterly peaceful, but he knew that the area around Latakia was anything but. It was in the hands of the Syrian regime and its proxies, but insurgent attacks were not uncommon. Here in the cabin with him were a dozen other men. He hadn't spoken to any of them, nor they to him, but he took them all for security contractors of some sort. A couple were Hispanic-looking, a couple more had to have been Japanese, one was black, and the rest were fit-looking bearded white guys, just like Court himself. They all sat in silence, their packs in their laps or by their sides. Over the airfield, Court had a moment of deep unease about his decision to come to Syria. Latakia's only airport, Mater Abdul Azam, had been divided into two separate entities with two separate names. The Russians had erected Himyemyum Air Base virtually on top of the commercial airport, and they effectively ran the vast majority of the place now. So much so that even before he touched down, he could see evidence of their presence everywhere. The first three aircraft Court saw upon landing all bore Russian military markings. A pair of Su-27 fighters and a massive Ilyushin IL-76 cargo jet were all taxiing to the parallel runway, and a long row of new and massive bomb-proof hangars to the east showed him that the Russians were dug in and planning on staying a while. Court had read that this was Russia's only fixed airbase outside its borders anywhere on Earth, which told him something about their commitment to maintaining influence over Syria. A Russian admiral had bragged that Hinemnyan was its newest unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Med, a boast Court understood better now as he looked around at the incredible amount of military aviation hardware on display. As his plane touched down and raced along the runway, it shot past a couple of Syrian Arab Air Force MiG-25 Foxbats, then a Russian Mi-8 helicopter, a pair of Russian MiG-29s, and more Russian and Syrian cargo and transport aircraft. The Saab turboprop taxied to the only non-military apron on the entire airfield and parked next to an Iranian commercial Airbus A320. And here, Court followed the other passengers and a member of the flight crew to the exit. He stepped through the hatch with just a small bag holding a small amount of clothing and gear, his orders from KWA, a wallet stuffed with euros, and his forged documents for Syrian immigration. Lars Klausner had assured him the KWA men working with the Desert Hawks would provide him everything he needed, and, since he'd been thoroughly searched by Syrian immigration officials on his arrival, there was no point taking anything he didn't need that might get confiscated. As he deplaned on the warm, sunny tarmac, a cluster of three armed Syrian officials greeted him and the others with bored nods, and together they walked up a metal stairway and into the terminal. Here, Syrian Arab army forces stood around acting as security, wearing camouflage uniforms. Court saw that most were outfitted with AK-103 rifles, and a few carried pistols. Several armed Russian soldiers were sitting around as well, which was an odd sight in an airport terminal, especially considering the fact that the men were armed but didn't seem to be providing any security or other function. As Court followed the immigration men down a long hall, he saw the flag of the regime, green, white, and black stripes with two green stars, hanging everywhere, along with photographs and paintings of Ahmed Azam. In some, the thin ruler of Syria wore business suits and smiled, and in others, he wore various military uniforms and scowled. But he was always there, always looming large over the airport terminal. Court figured he'd be seeing a lot of Ahmed's face in the coming days. The American, posing as a Canadian, was x-rayed, wanded, and frisked. His satchel of gear was perfunctorily inspected by unsmiling men, who seemed more interested in their next smoke break than capturing an assassin entering their nation by private aircraft. Probably, Court surmised, since there were hundreds of private security contractors in the country, and they were constantly coming and going via this same route. But when his Inmarsat satellite phone was pulled out of his bag and looked over, the customs inspector confiscated it. "No phone," the man said. Court was next separated from the other contractors and led to a desk in the immigration office, where they took his documents, looked them over, then looked Court himself over. An official there made a call, and soon a middle-aged, mustachioed man in a gray suit appeared, and he took the passport and checked both it and Court over even more carefully than the immigration officer had. Court took the man to be from Syria's Mukhabarat. The man with the mustache finally handed the passport back to the immigration officer, and he leaned over his shoulder while he checked it against a computer in front of him. As he did, he addressed Court in accented English.
"You are Graham Wade from Canada."
Court nodded.
"That's right." "You are KWA. Contracted to Liwa Sukur al-Sahara."
"The Desert Hawks Brigade, right again." The immigration officer began typing on his computer. Soon, a printer behind him fired out several pages, and the official stamped them with three different embossing tools, folded them, and placed them in a plastic jacket. He stamped the passport and handed it all back to Court. The Mukhabarat man said,
"You are permitted to enter the Syrian Arab Republic, but you are not permitted to travel off your military base unless escorted by an officer of the Desert Hawks, the Mukhabarat, or the Ministry of the Interior. Failure to comply means you will be subject to arrest and expulsion, or arrest and a prison term.
Court said, no wandering around. Got it.
Photography, audio recordings, map making, telephones for personal use, and GPS devices are prohibited.
Okay. Court was allowed to pass, and when he stepped out into the arrivals hall, he saw more uniformed Russians, as well as a large group of men in business suits pulling along hand luggage. These men, Court assumed, were Iranians, either diplomats, businessmen, or a mixture of both, getting ready to leave on the Airbus he'd seen on the tarmac. The other mercs from his flight all found their rides, and they trickled out of the terminal. Court, on the other hand, stood there in the middle of the small arrivals hall for a few minutes, and then, when he saw no one there to greet him, he walked out the front of the building and into the sunshine. Across the parking lot, he saw a beige pickup with a machine gun mounted in the back and four men standing around it. They wore Western-looking print military uniforms, but they were all clearly Arab men. They didn't look his way, so Court kept hunting for the KWA man he had been told he would meet here at the airport. He noticed a bald man in cargo pants leaning against a newer-looking white Toyota pickup truck. He was just a couple of spaces away from the four men in desert camo, but he didn't seem to be associating with them at all. The man gazed in Court's direction, standing with his hands on his hips and a pair of wraparound sunglasses hanging out of his mouth by one of the arms. He was stocky, with a thick chest and forearms covered in tattoos, and he wore a black t-shirt. The man made no move in Court's direction, but he kept looking right at him. It was no big trick for Court to identify the person he was here to meet. Court would be interacting with some hard men on this operation, so he'd not expected balloons and a banner. He walked over to the man and extended his hand. "I'm Wade." The bald man put on his shades, pushed off the vehicle, and ignored the handshake. He replied with a Cockney accent.
"Remains to be seen."
"What's that?"
"You are whoever your KWA deployment orders say you are."
"Yes, sir." Court was in cover now, and he knew he needed to act and talk like a private security officer on a high-threat contract. He'd worked around such men on different assignments around the world, and he'd trained with some of the more high-speed contractors stateside. He fished out his KWA folio from his backpack and handed it over to the Brit. The man took the papers, looked them over, then returned his gaze to Court. He spoke softly, even though there was no one in earshot.
"First things first, mate. I'm Saunders. I'm not Sir. I'm labor, not management, and I don't need some terrorist sapper thinking differently. We straight on that?"
Court doubted there were any insurgents sneaking around here at the Russian-Syrian regime airbase, and if there were, he felt confident they would have higher priority targets around here than a couple of guys in t-shirts standing in a parking lot. But he didn't argue.
"Saunders, got it."
Court could tell Saunders had been around. He had an impossibly hard, weathered air about him. Even though this guy might have been labor, he was clearly a veteran employee of Klossner's organization, and since he was British, this probably meant he could well have been former Royal Marines or SAS, Special Air Service, the UK's elite special operations unit. Court couldn't help but wonder what had befallen the man to where he now found himself working as a mercenary, employed on a contract with a militia of cold-blooded murderers in Syria. But he didn't ask. Saunders said,
"All right, here's what's gonna happen. Those blokes are with us."
He nodded to the four men in camo uniforms standing around the technical. They were all looking Court's way now.
"They are Desert Hawks Brigade, and they go where we go, just to make sure we get there. We've got a long drive ahead, all the way to our base just east of Damascus and Babala. It's 300 clicks, and it's not gonna be a joyride. So we're gonna tag along with a convoy that's forming up in Jablay, just 15 minutes from here."
Saunders led Court to the passenger side of the white Toyota, and Court opened the door. A set of body armor and an SA-80 bullpup rifle lay on the floorboard.
"Is this for me?"
Court asked as he sat down and put his feet on the gear. Saunders climbed in on his side.
"No, mate, that's my kit. You'll get your kit once we get down to Babila. But we'll find a surplus weapon and armor for you to take along on the convoy."
Both men had to show their credos twice before leaving the airport, but once outside, the bald man stomped on the gas and raced to the south. Behind them, the Desert Hawk technical followed, with one man standing in the bed holding onto the machine gun. They rode in silence for a moment, but just when Court thought Saunders wasn't going to do any talking, the man said,
"Today's your lucky day, Wade. That is, assuming you came down here to see some action. You and me are going to get shot at this afternoon."
On the road to Damascus? As they made the turn off the highway that led towards Jablay, the Brit nodded.
"It's been a bloody shooting gallery for the past few weeks. I came up here in a convoy the day before yesterday on the same road we'll be taking back. We got hit twice in the hills. Small arms, nothing coordinated. Still, two SAA blokes traveling with us were hit. One of the poor salts didn't make it through the night. Shot in the bum he was, which would be a laugh if it hadn't clipped his femoral."
He looked over to Court.
"And last week, Daesh cut off the highway for 90 minutes, killed 7 civilians and 2 Syrian cops. FSA, Daesh, Al-Nusra. That highway goes right through the middle of the territory of a lot of enemy groups."
Court nodded in a casual manner.
"How are we supposed to know who is who?"
The question seemed to surprise Saunders, and he thought about it for a moment.
"Sometimes you see blokes waving flags, sometimes you see kit or clothing that tells you who you're up against, but you usually only have time to ID the colors on the bodies after you kill the buggers. Does it matter? If some bloke is shooting at you, shoot back at him. We got a hard job down here, Wade, but that part's dead easy."
Right. Except it wasn't so easy for Court. Jabhat al-Nusra was the local brand of Al-Qaeda, and Daesh was ISIS. He'd pour lead at either of those groups if he ran into them, no questions asked. But FSA was the Free Syrian Army, and while it was a loose coalition made up of a lot of disparate elements, in theory at least, they were the good guys in this fight. Court, on the other hand, was most assuredly working on the side of the villains down here. Would he really open fire on an FSA unit attacking the Russian and Syrian regime forces? He told himself all he could do was hope he didn't come into contact with FSA fighters and sort out what he would do if the time came. As they drove along in silence, Court realized Saunders wasn't going through the typical security contractor process of asking who he knew and where he'd been. It was commonly referred to in the industry as butt-sniffing, a way of sizing up others in the field to establish one another's bona fides. Court had answers ready if Saunders asked, and he expected the grilling. Wade was a pseudonym, but Court was here in place of a real man with a real background Court had studied on the flight from Munich to Beirut. But Saunders hadn't asked a thing about his past or his experience. Court appreciated the silence, but on top of this, it only made him more certain of his assumption that the guys he'd come into contact with down here would be cut from a different cloth than the private military contractors he'd worked around in the past. These men were straight-up mercs, and they were not here for the camaraderie or any belief in the righteousness of their mission. They arrived at a small Syrian Arab army base just after 1. Both men climbed out of the pickup, headed into a guard shack, and handed over their embossed KWA badges and travel papers. Still, they were frisked for explosive vests, and the pickup was checked over thoroughly for bombs. Back in the truck, they waited for the Desert Hawks traveling behind them to make it through security, and then they all drove to a row of low buildings within sight of the ocean to the west. A group of 4 light-duty military trucks of various makes and models sat single file in a lot out front. Court saw 2 trucks with Russian military markings and 2 older and larger trucks with the markings of the Syrian Arab Army. Saunders said,
"This is our convoy. We don't leave until 1320, so we've got a little time to find you a weapon."
Court followed Saunders into a warehouse, where the British contractor spoke with some Syrian Arab Army soldiers. After yet another show of badges and some signing of some forms Court couldn't read, a squeaky padlock was removed from a squeaky door, and they were led into a room full of weaponry. AKs stacked on tables and shelves, along with ammunition, cases of big green helmets, and stacks of steel body armor in chest rigs. Court could see dust hanging in the air. The smell of gunpowder and gun oil was thick in Court's nostrils. The American said,
"Let me guess. You want me to take one of these pieces of shit?"
"Like I said, you'll get a proper weapon when we get down to our base. But we want you ready for today's run. You can borrow what you need here for the drive down. This is what they hand out to the civilian regime-backed militias."
The equipment was decidedly low-tech, but Kort had trained on and implemented in the field weapons of all types and quality. He pulled on a heavy olive drab vest that held armor plates, and then he stepped over to choose a rifle. If given any choice for a weapon to take on a mission such as today, he would have chosen an HK416A6 rifle with an 11-inch barrel and a Gemtech suppressor and a second 20-inch barrel that he could exchange with the 11-inch if he found himself pinned down by shooters at long range, along with a holographic weapon sight and a quick detach 3-power scope. His rifle would have a laser acquisition device, a high-lumen flashlight with a pressure switch, a 6-position adjustable stock with an adjustable check weld, and a horizontal forward grip. Yeah, that would have been his dream choice for a vehicle operation through a high-threat area. But this grungy and small armory had probably never seen anything like that. Instead, he pulled a worn-out and worm-holed wooden-stocked AK-47 with simple iron sights off a rack. It was virtually identical to the model invented by wounded tank crewman Mikhail Kalashnikov back in 1947, but Kort knew AKs, and he could use the weapon with deadly effect out to 500 yards. He checked its function and deemed it in proper working order. As he adjusted the weapon's old nylon sling for his height and preference, Saunders loaded a big canvas satchel with rusty 30-round magazines. He handed the satchel over to the man he knew as Wade, who immediately put the heavy sack down on a table and began counting the magazines.
14 mags, 420 rounds, Kort said. That's more than I've ever carried in my life.
Even though he was in character, it was the truth, at least when carrying a weapon that fired a big 7.62 round like the Kalashnikov. He picked up the magazines one at a time, loaded them into his chest rig, locked one into his new rifle, and racked around into the chamber. He flipped the safety up, then pushed the 5 remaining magazines away on the table.
I'll go with 270, just in case we get attacked by Godzilla.
The Brit looked at him like he was an idiot.
Right. So you've made the Latakia Damascus run before, have you now?
You know I have not.
Well, I have, so listen to me. Through the hills east of Latakia, through Masyaf, across Homa, down around Homs, and south through the northern suburbs of Damascus, blown to rubble by the regime, but still full of rebels. The entire route could be crawling with roving terrorists and marauders, popping out at every turn. You probably won't need all this ammo, but if you do, you'll bloody well wish you had it.
Kort thought the guy was exaggerating, but the voice of his former CIA trainer slipped into his mind again, telling him there was virtually never such a thing as too much ammunition. Kort scooped up 3 of the 5 mags, crammed them into his pockets in his cargo pants, then lumbered for the door. The convoy prepping to make the run to Damascus was a multinational affair. Kort and Saunders were the only Westerners and the only foreign mercs in the group, but there were 2 nearly new Gaz light military transport trucks containing a dozen or so armed Russian soldiers, 2 Russian-made Zil 131 Syrian Arab Army trucks with what appeared to be about 20 young infantrymen, and the 4 Desert Hawks Brigade soldiers who'd been caravanning along with Kort and Saunders. There was also a black Land Rover with 3 Arabs in civilian clothes. Kort nodded towards the men and asked Saunders who they were. Saunders himself gave them a curious eye.
Probably Mook.
Mook?
Kort asked, although he knew.
Mukhabarov, Syrian intel. I have a meeting with the Russians and Syrians at the lead vehicle. Maybe I'll find out, but I'm not gonna ask about them. You stay here with the Hawks.
Saunders went forward to talk to the leaders of each group represented, and he returned a few minutes later.
Right. Those blokes in suits are definitely Mook. They'll be riding right in front of us in the middle of the formation. The SAA will take the front and the rear of the convoy. The 2 Russian trucks will travel together behind the lead vehicle. We leave in 5 marks.
Even though he wasn't a security contractor, Kort knew vehicle operations in high-threat areas better than most.
What's our plan if we come upon a downed vehicle or a firefight going on in the road? Do we assist?
Negative. You and me are being paid by the Hawks, so our job is to get down to the base in Babila and do what we're told. We aren't being paid to fight it out with the rebels along the highway. We'll let some other poor bugger do that. If the Russians and the SAA don't stop, we don't stop. If they do stop, well,
I will make the decision on whether we keep going or stick with the convoy.
Court said, 7 light vehicles, 45 men, and 1 mounted machine gun might scare off a small unit of adversaries, but anything larger might see us as an opportunity. Saunders rolled his eyes.
Off a bleeding bird less than an hour, and you're telling me how to roll. Is that it, Wade?
Hey, Court said. Your labor, just like me. Remember?
Saunders spit on the dusty asphalt.
We won't be the only vehicles on the road, so the trick is just to make ourselves a harder target than the other sons of bitches out there, so the bad guys shoot somebody else.
That's our plan?
Saunders donned his body armor, pulled his rifle out of the floorboard of the pickup, racked around into the chamber, then checked to make sure the safety was engaged.
I told you, Wade. We're gonna get shot at today. Might as well sit back and enjoy the lovely weather till it happens.
He headed around to the driver's seat. There was nothing Cork could do but slip on his sunglasses, climb into the passenger side of the pickup, hold his old Kalashnikov at the ready, and begin scanning his sector. It was going to be a long afternoon. He could feel it. Chapter 28 French Judicial Police Captain Henri Sauvage drove south out of Paris in an early afternoon rain shower. He had a lot on his mind, but he pushed it away as much as possible to focus on the task of the moment. Ahead on his right, halfway through a wooded area that covered a square kilometer, a gravel driveway wound back into the woods. Sauvage didn't slow his 2-door Renault as he approached it, but he peered intently up the drive while passing, doing his best to take in every detail. And when it was behind him, he kept driving. Traffic was steady, and it occurred to him he might not find a place to turn around to head back for a while. Still, his job was not to go back. At least, it wasn't yet. And he hoped like hell he wouldn't be given that order by the Syrians who controlled him. He took out his phone and placed a call. As soon as he heard the call go through, he spoke.
The gate is closed at the entrance. No one is in sight.
Good,
came the reply. A kilometer behind him, the Syrian asset he knew as Malik sat in the passenger seat of a Volkswagen Touran van, and he drove down the same road Sauvage drove on. Sauvage could hear him relay his message to the men in the vehicle with him in Arabic.
What do I do now?
Sauvage asked into the phone.
We'll pass by the property in 30 seconds. Then we'll meet you in Saint-Forget on the Rue de la Motte.
Sauvage thought Malik's French pronunciation was horrendous, but he didn't say so. Still, he had done what was asked of him today, so the Frenchman did push back a little into the phone.
Why do you need me? I told you what I found out about the property. I led you here. Just let me go home.
Rue de la Motte, 10 minutes.
The phone call ended. Henri Sauvage tossed his phone down into the passenger seat and shouted curses to himself. He had gone to Foss's funeral 2 hours earlier and would be attending Allard's the following day. André Clément's body had not yet turned up, but since Sauvage saw him die, he knew it wouldn't be long at all before he'd be going to his partner's funeral as well. And as bad as Sauvage's mood was now, he figured by the time he hugged Clément's children at his graveside, he'd be ready to kill himself for everything he'd gotten his friend involved with. The thought of saying to hell with it all and killing himself, thereby outsmarting Eric and the Syrians manipulating him, did have a moment's appeal to him. But then he thought better of it. No, he wasn't going to kill himself. He was going to be a good little bitch for Eric, and he would do what he was told, make his money, then take his family and get the fuck out of here. The best revenge was a life well lived, and he told himself he owed it to his dead friends to enjoy himself on their behalf. He was being paid a lot of money to find Bianca Medina, and he was reasonably certain he had done just that. He'd spend it well. 10 minutes later, Sauvage leaned against the hood of his car parked at the flower market in the town of Saint-Forget. The Volkswagen van pulled up and the sliding back door opened. Sauvage just stood there.
No, I'm not getting back in that van.
Malik rolled his eyes.
Of course you are, man. Because if you don't, we shoot you right now.
He heard the shik-shik sound of a pistol slide being racked in the darkness of the van, and his fantasy of retaining some control over his life melted away in an instant. Savage climbed into the vehicle. The van pulled out of the flower market parking lot, and Savage sat on the bare floor against the wall, facing two of Malik's men. The plastic tarp had been removed, which should have made Savage feel better, but he figured these men would shoot him and just hose out the back if it came down to it. Malik himself climbed out of the passenger seat and into the back, squatting down in front of the French police captain.
Tell me how you know the woman is being held at the property. Everyone has been looking for the Halabis since my colleagues were found dead in their flat. A team at La Crime has spent 100 man-hours watching videos of the Free Syria Exile Union, and they have identified 13 key members of the outfit. They tracked the phones of all these men and women, and physically surveilled some of them, but so far they haven't found any connection to here. So, I did find a connection. I expanded my search to family members of the Halabis. A nephew of Rima was geo-tracked to this estate last night, and he is still inside. I arrived here at 5:30 this morning, and shortly after 7 a.m., a European man in his 60s pulled in. I took a photo of him, blew it up so I could see it, and determined I was looking at Vincent Voland, former intelligence official and currently employed by the Halabis.
Malik was impressed.
So, he's in there right now? Yes, along with two men who look very much like Syrians. Not the nephew I'd originally targeted, so apparently there are more people in that house. What do you know about the residents? I know nothing, which means I know a lot. Elaborate. The property is registered to a shell corporation in the Cook Islands. Any research into the ownership, who is living there, what goes on there, just dead ends. And to you this means? It means it's either owned by a business with an interest in hiding its physical property, or it's some sort of a DGSE or DGSI safehouse. The fact that Voland is here leads me to the latter assumption. He's officially retired from the government, but my assumption is he's working with the FSEU while retaining contacts in French intelligence.
Sauvage could see the worry in Malik's eyes, and this relaxed him. Thank God the Syrian realized they were all in over their heads. Sauvage pressed.
That's right. The French government might be involved. Are you guys really going to roll into that estate with your guns out, ready to take off with that woman?
Malik did not answer. Instead, he asked,
how long until the police find this place? How the hell should I know?
Eric will not like that response.
Sauvage sighed.
Je ne sais pas.
I don't know.
There's no surveillance on the place by us yet. No chatter about it around La Crime. But it's just a matter of time before someone connects the dots. If there are other members of the FSEU here, and the federal police are investigating them, then either my people at La Crime or the federal police will find their way here, sooner or later.
Malik said, Eric has communicated with us. He will be here tonight.
Sauvage said,
and then what will you do?
I'll do whatever Eric orders me to do. Same as you, if you are smart.
I was brought into this for intelligence, surveillance.
Malik said, and I'm sure that will remain your main role. But we will need you close by.
Savage shrugged.
Just call me when he gets here and I will-
No!
The van stopped, the door opened. As before, the driver had gone in a circle, and they were now back at Sauvage's car in the parking lot of the flower market.
One of my men will accompany you until Eric arrives.
For what purpose?
I see how scared you are. Your attendance this evening is required. We would not want you running off.
Of course I'm scared. I'm not a killer. I'm not an accessory to murder either.
Interesting. Eric tells me you are one of his best.
Sauvage closed his eyes.
I didn't want any of this. Did you want this?
Sauvage opened his eyes. Malik held a rolled up wad of euros the size of a grapefruit.
The fuck is that? I have an account in Cyprus where I-
Walking around money. From Eric. A way to show our gratitude, and perhaps an easier way to help you get out of town when this is over.
tonight. Sauvage took the money. He always took the money. Chapter 29 Saunders and Gentry drove in the center of the small convoy to the southeast, first